There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello, welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel. I'm your host, and with me today, of course, is Drew Tirico, Media Geek producer. And today, we'll be talking about indecency and about independent music, but not how they relate. Two different topics. And yes, unfortunately, the first topic isn't brought on by Janet Jackson's You Know What. But we hope we can shed some light on that, actually. That may be useful to everyone thinking about it in terms of our true media environment, not just one little incident during the Super Bowl. So you do want to stay tuned. So, Drew, everyone's been talking about this week, and it's probably one of the biggest incidents to bring another issue of broadcast regulation to the forefront in American news and culture. Can you fill us in on some details here?
Well, I think I tried to leave some of the details out of this little written introduction that I prepared. But
it's hard to avoid that, you know, the big deal is that part of Janet Jackson's breast was revealed during a Super Bowl.
That's the gist of it.
Super Bowl halftime show with lots of talk about whether it was intentional or not intentional, everything else. Mm-hmm. But we're going to leave such things aside.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you something here, though. So, the Super Bowl halftime show that became the most talked about item all week, it isn't grassroots or independent media, quite the contrary, but any event that causes sweaty palms in the CBS boardroom and a straight week of tactical analysis from every mainstream journalist with a pulse sends ripples throughout the media, no matter how independent. For example, I have no idea who won the game or even which teams played, but I know what happened to Janet Jackson and her breast. Now, we media geeks would like to turn this event into something substantial for all of us to learn from. What we've been given is a spectacle of the grandest proportions, and our reason is pinned to the floor under the weight of trivia that's been shoved on us by an industry that goes out and buys another summer home when big news breaks. But the industry itself is actually held at the point of this issue, and the FCC is sharpening its blade under pressure from quote-unquote family values. Meanwhile, TV networks are dulling their own standards to compete for the attention of an ever more jaded public. So, what we're going to try to get at here is the issue of indecency, and what makes this an issue of indecency, and not just an accidental slip-up, not just a ratings nightmare. Why don't you fill us in on some of the precedents of indecency?
Well, and this is something which the FCC is being has been slowly getting more flack from, mostly from Congress, because that's who they listen to only just about, aside from the industry, as more and more people have complained both about sex and violence. And one of their own commissioners, Michael Copps, has been making this one of his big issues next to media ownership since he joined the FCC a number of years ago. And indecency is something which the FCC is allowed to regulate. It's a way of regulating speech on broadcast, because broadcast is thought to be different than a newspaper or a magazine, where they're ostensibly free reign to do what you please. So publishing, say, you know, Janet Jackson's nipple in a in a newspaper, while some newspapers won't do it, there's nothing illegal about it, and the FCC has no jurisdiction over dealing with it. But according to the 1978 Supreme Court decision, FCC v. Pacifica, the Supreme Court says the FCC does have the right to regulate the airwaves with regard to content when it comes to indecency, but does not have the absolute right. And the times at which it has the right to do so are between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. It's called the Free Harbor. And the idea is that the Supreme Court used in its opinion at that time was that the FCC should have the right to regulate the airwaves to protect children from adult matter, but to also allow there to be more challenging adult matter on the airwaves, meaning that we should not all be reduced to only seeing media which is suitable for children. And indeed, that there should be media suitable for adults. And that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be pornographic, but that obviously, you know, look at even just a PG-13 movie has content that is far racier than you see on television.
Right.
And I think you have in front of you there, and it comes actually to the WEF volunteer manual.
Exactly.
The FCC definition of indecency.
That's right. This is given to all WEF volunteers because they want us to understand what the issue is at stake here and what you can or cannot say. So, but the FCC's language is kind of vague, unfortunately. Indecent language occurs when language is broadcast which, quote, describes in terms patently offensive as measured by contemporary community standards where the broadcast medium, sexual or excretory activities and organs, end quote. So, I mean, that kind of leaves anything up in the air, and you could argue that these sexual or excretory organs are used in an artistic manner, I think. So, patently offensive as measured by contemporary community standards. That's, you know, I think it's purposely vague language, isn't it? I
mean, it is purposely vague language. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to get at. And about 2 years ago, the FCC released a policy paper, which they had been ordered to do so by Congress to clarify. And it's this enormous document that goes over precedents within FCC's own cases of indecency where it has pursued people or fined different broadcasters, going over why they did fine, why they didn't fine. And so much of way people have thought about indecency has gone back to the George Carlin skit, Seven Words You Can Never Say on Television, which is what brought about the FCC v. Pacifica lawsuit in the Supreme Court. And people have always reduced it, well, you can't say these seven words. And the FCC's policy statement said basically, no, that's not it. It's the use of these words in context. And so one particular case that they did not find was on NPR, where they played a tape of a mafioso. And it was a FBI tape, and they played it as part of a news story, and they did not bleep out all the various swears. And the FCC chose specifically not to fine, because they said it was part of a news broadcast. Those were not words being used in sexual excretory ways. They were simply expletives. It was part of a legitimate news broadcast. It wasn't there simply to titillate or simply to offend. By comparison, the FCC has fined stations, especially stations with morning programs, that have had people swearing but bleeped out, where you still know what the swear is, but, you know, it's sort of on the surface, it's gone. And they have levied fines for that and said, well, you know, those words are being used in context that met the indecency, and we all understand and we know it's there. Simply bleeping out is not good enough. And indeed, in the recent case we talked about last week, where Clear Channel was fined about $750,000 for various incidents on the Bubba the Love Sponge show, some of those incidents did involve swear words that had been bleeped out. And they said, regardless of the fact that you bleeped them, it's understood, the context was clear, it was sexual excretory, and it was offensive by the community standards of these stations in Florida. And one of the things that Michael Copps and the FCC has done, and is not being done right now, really, in the mainstream media treatment, is connecting up this issue with ownership. And one of the things that Michael Copps has said is that it is under this increasing concentration of media that there's a race to the bottom. I mean, for example, you know, Howard Stern, let's take him as a case in point, was a New York DJ, and he was at a New York station. And it was only when he got onto a station that eventually was bought by Infinity Corporation, now part of Viacom, did the show start to be broadcast in Philadelphia and cities all over the country. And that impulse to sort of take what started out really as a local program and move it all across is really greatly enhanced by concentration. Why? It's a lot cheaper to pay one guy a few million dollars a year to host a program on all your stations than to try and have a morning show on every station you own that's local. Even if that person doesn't get paid nearly as much money, just the management overhead, all the oversight and everything else. As we've seen in the most extreme example with Clear Channel, which likes to take its content and spread it across all of its stations and not try to have local ownership.
Right.
And I think we see, you know, with the CBS Viacom case here with the Super Bowl, it's a little more mixed since network television has been a longstanding element. But you notice that no one is taking credit for the incident. It's the old MTV, you know, it was this, because they have all these different factors and this enormous multinational corporation coming together to produce this broadcast in a way that was simply not true 10 or 15 years ago.
Right, so they're talking about now, I guess there's the different the way they can levy fines, and there's been discussion of actually levying fines against each individual community broadcaster that is owned by CBS.
That's right.
Which would result in billions of dollars in fines.
Well, the interesting, and that's interesting, because again, in that Clear Channel case last year, which is typically how it's always happened, the fine was not levied directly against Clear Channel, it was levied against the individual stations. Mm-hmm. When we talk about broadcast indecency, we're always talking about individual complaints against individual licensees. So, for example, if nobody from Champaign-Urbana writes a letter and complains about our local CBS affiliate carrying that and being angry, they probably won't get a fine. But if all the people in New York do, it'll be the CBS affiliate in New York. Now, that affiliate happens to be owned by CBS, which is Viacom. Mm-hmm. Our affiliate here in Illinois is not. It's owned by Nexstar Corporation. And they would be responsible for what goes out on their airways. So ostensibly, with complaints from Champaign-Urbana area, the fine could end up going to Nexstar Corporation because they held the broadcast license for the station that broadcast the indecency.
So does that comes from this by contemporary community standards sort of language? Is that where that comes from?
That's exactly where it comes from, because the idea is, even though it's sort of a joke at this point in corporate media ownership, licenses are licensed to a community to serve a particular community. So it's community standards, and it is complaints from within that community that count. My writing a letter complaining about CBS sort of in general doesn't necessarily make it important until I've said WCIA TV Channel 3, and they can assign it to someone for blame.
All right.
And it only counts for broadcast. I do want to know. So if I happen to be watching it over, if I had been watching it, let's say, a closed circuit feed of the Super Bowl, or I'd been watching it over DirecTV, and it wasn't coming through a local affiliate, it wouldn't matter any longer.
Right.
So these are only broadcast licenses. But,
cable TV, right?
It does not count for cable TV. It only counts for signals that went over the air, originated over the air. That is what broadcast means. Everything else is a separate sort of issue.
Interesting.
And so this is how all these issues sort of get intertwined and don't really, you know, get looked at. And what everyone, of course, is interested in is all the numbers and what happens. And this it's amazing how quickly the FCC could spring into action this week with the chair, Michael Powell, being all upset about trying to this blue ribbon panel. I mean, it took less time for that than it took to look into the intelligence behind Iraq or to look into local ownership or, 12 other issues at the FCC.
Exactly. This raced to the top of their list no time.
But as a larger issue, I mean, already the FCC was coming under fire for not going after violent and sexual broadcasting. And I will say that it is my own personal opinion, I always get a little scared when people start looking at indecency, because it has been used so many times in the past, again, to go look after Pacifica, which is a progressive organization, and to go after art that is challenging, and to go after speech, which is challenging. Pacifica was pursued for indecency in the 1960s for hosting a at the time, explicit conversation about marijuana usage. That was considered indecent, that they have someone who smokes marijuana talk about it on air and in a clear manner and not from the manner of you shouldn't be doing this. And so we look at this, and it is one way which is being used to get at these big broadcasters, but we should also be careful because it can be used to get at the smaller ones amongst us, Pacifica, like us.
There was a local, I know, play that went on in San Francisco about the characters had AIDS, and there was a play that was about that, and there were complaints about that, and I think
the radio play,
and that was the indecency was used there.
Yeah, I mean, don't know a lot about that case.
I don't either, but I know that it was used. You know, the play was obviously being used in a way that to educate people about
and it was explicit, but it was explicit because it's a sexually transmitted disease. You know, and in a way to not dance around issues, they thought it had to be explicit for people to understand. So this is a conversation we could have probably for hours.
Exactly.
Here.
Exactly, but the end result is that you in the community, us people here in Urbana-Champaign, actually have the power to file a complaint with the FCC about your local affiliate about this, and that's the most interesting part of it. It's not a national problem. This is actually comes down to
it does come down to the local. And what's interesting is that it's not just that incident. I mean, if you know, and you can complain about the licensees doing anything, which can also mean if you think that your local television stations are not serving the public interest, not airing enough news, not airing enough public affairs, you can write a letter to the FCC to complain about that. It does get read and it does get filed.
mm-hmm.
and it does go into a file with that light. It may or may not get paid attention to, but if there's enough people coordinated writing such letters, you have an opportunity. So it exposes just the public's little bit of opportunity for participation in the process beyond just this mm-hmm. one incident, which, of course, never gets covered. So what we do want to get covered here, though, is some more talk about independent music. Let's turn 360 here.
That's right.
Or 180 degrees. Well, not full circle. 180 degrees away from CBS, Viacom, and MTV, and the anti-MTV.
Right, exactly. Well, this is on a related note, I suppose. I mean, this is, again, community issues. These are community... We're going to be talking to a couple of people that organize shows in their community for music or for, you know, various performance media that we're going to be talking to Rotten Milk about, first of all. We did an interview with him a few weeks ago about his work at WZRD, which is the radio station 88.3 FM in Chicago, and he runs some other things outside of WZRD and in conjunction with WZRD, some shows that he books at bars that are weekly occurring series that he tries to put on for free. And then we're going to be talking to the Independent Media Center. Arun Bala is here with us. He's going to be talking to us about our local Independent Media Center. So here's Rotten Milk. First,
I know you do this together with the radio station. That's why I want to bring it up, because you have a lot of the same artists that you have come on the radio station that you have to play music and discuss politics with you. You bring them outside of the radio station too. You've organized weekly events. You used to call them Rotten Tuesdays, I believe. I'm not sure if I know you've got a new one now. Are you still calling it Rotten Tuesdays? Why don't you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I do a show now every Tuesday night. I work with these people, Ken and Richard Siska, who used to run a coffee shop / experimental music venue in Chicago called the Nervous Center. And I'm working mm-hmm. with them to do a show every Tuesday night, and we do these sort of avant-garde music and sometimes video as well, sound nights, and people, we have different styles of music. It might vary from week to week, from sort of beat-driven electronic music to just noise, to kind of spaced out rock kind of stuff, to ambient blissful soundscapes, all sorts of different things. And then a lot of times there's a crew of visual artists who will show up and mix video and so forth behind them. And it's also a showcase for DJs and so forth. And it's a free event. It's always free. That's very important to me. And this is kind of, we did these shows for about a year under the name Rotten Tuesday, and now we're doing them at a different venue, and they don't really have a name, per se. A lot of people still call it Rotten Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. I know, are you still serving food? I know you used to even have food at the old Rotten Tuesdays at the Leadway, where you used to have it.
The Leadway Bar used to provide free food for us. Now we have food for sale at this new place.
Oh, okay.
We do them at a coffee shop in Chicago. Oh, it's a coffee shop, and now it's a bar. They just got a liquor license.
Oh, really?
In Chicago, called Hottie Biscotti, and it's on Drake and Fullerton. And there's food for sale and coffee for sale and spirits for sale.
And spirits.
But the show itself is free.
Mm-hmm. So the coffee shop doesn't charge you. They just kind of take in from the sales of food and liquor and coffee and stuff, but they let you have the place for free?
Right, they don't charge us anything. And I also do a series every Wednesday at a space in Chicago called Buddy, which is kind of it's a politically active gallery / performance space in the heart of Wicker Park. And we have a series called Improvise with Your Buddy, and it's an improvised new music series. And we have groups of people that come to improvise together, and then we also have a part of the series is a game I thought up called Improv Lotto, and people put their names in a hat, and then we pull the names out of the hat at random, and I'll roll a die and say it says four, and so I'll pull four names out of the hat, and then those four people have to improvise together. And what winds up happening is you get someone who is a jazz player
mm-hmm.
who gets stuck playing with someone who plays beats, who gets stuck playing with someone who makes noise. Who gets stuck playing with someone who doesn't really know how to play music at all. And that was kind of my goal, was to get people at different skill levels and get people from different, who are coming from different different directions, taking different approaches to music, to play together. And this is kind of, I felt like, you know, there's a large improvised music scene in Chicago, but I feel like a lot of times people, and I'm certainly guilty of this, people wind up playing with the same four or five people over and over again because they're comfortable playing with them. And that's great. That's a great way to write music and a great way to work. But I'm not sure how truly the name improvisation can be applied to that. And so I was really just trying to break down some of people's walls and some of the ideas that people tend to impose on how they improvise with this series. And it's been going for a year now, and it's been pretty successful. I've seen some people meet up for the first time due to this series who have since played together in other situations. And I considered seeing that. I consider the series a success.
Oh, great.
And this series is also free. It's a workshop. It's free of charge, and it happens every Wednesday at this space, Buddy, which is located at 1542 North Milwaukee Avenue, just by the major intersection of Damon North and Milwaukee in Chicago.
Yeah, and I just want to mention for people that aren't familiar with Buddy, I know Buddy's probably the closest thing to sort of an IMC space that Chicago has. Am I correct in saying that? Because I know Chicago doesn't have an IMC space, but it's a very collectively run space where a lot of different groups meet there and have different events there. And this is
We don't have an IMC space, although we have done shows with Chicago's indiemedia.org chapter, and it's a leftist leaning space. It's run by a collective, like the offices of Lumpen Magazine are in this space. And then there's a video production company who has their offices in this space. And it's just run by these people and then various other people who become involved. And basically, my involvement with the space is just I just kept going there. And I kept, I knew some of the people there, and I just kept hanging out and going to events. And eventually, I became a part of it, and we have a lot of shows there that are teaching people, some discussing like tactical media ideas and ways to fight what's going on. And we've had a lot of agitprop making shows there. We've done workshops on pirate radio and workshops about stencil making or making clothes or how to safely organize and protest. And, a lot of groups meet there to discuss these ideas. And it's really grown quite beautifully, and to the point where now there's another space above Buddy called High School that's having a lot of free classes for people on various subjects and a lot of community meetings and just discussions about all kinds of issues. And so, yeah, it is. It is it's similar to the Independent Media Center in a way. This is sort of a public space that could be used for all sorts of different reasons.
Yeah, I wanted to emphasize that. I mean, from my impression of it was that it's this very public access oriented space. Anyone like yourself, you walked in and you hung out there for a little while and you were given the opportunity to to have a weekly series there. So that's
pretty much anyone mostly shows are often booked just by people just come to the meetings and people present their ideas and we say anyone who's at the meeting kind of has a say and everyone just kind of decides as a group what shows we want to have and what shows we don't. Currently there's an art show up there called Jesus Saves in time for the holidays, and it's kind of examining Christianity and pop culture and the intersection of the two. And the back porch of the Buddy space runs alongside the Blue Line train, which is one of the main trains in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And out on the back porch, the people who put together the show had built a manger scene, nativity scene, out of giant Jack Schick style pamphlets, the religious propaganda tracks.
Wow.
Those cartoons you can find.
Yeah, right. Those are the cartoon pamphlets that have Bible quotes and a little sort of skit.
Right, right.
Can
tell you if you don't shape up, you're going to go to hell.
Right.
They blew a few of these up, and they made these giant stand-up Jack Schick pamphlets and made a nativity scene out of them. And within a few days, the CPA had called the city of Chicago and complained, and the city of Chicago called the landlord and complained, and basically they threatened that if we didn't take down the nativity, which they deemed graffiti,
graffiti.
That we would be fined $500 if we didn't have it down by nightfall.
Hmm.
So we really were left with no recourse but to take it down.
Wow.
this is unfortunate, but so.
Yeah, really. Well, what happened to freedom of speech?
Yeah, well, I guess it's different where the CTA is involved.
All right. Yeah, well, CTA.
Chicago's graffiti. Chicago, if you're not familiar with graffiti in Chicago, it's a major concern of our fine mayor, and he's
that's Mayor Daley.
Really comes down very hard on the graffiti thing. It's really unfortunate. I go to other cities, and it's so beautiful. You see some real artists doing a lot of work. That's really amazing. And then you come to Chicago, and it's really oppressive if you're a graffiti artist. We've had a lot, buddy. We've had a lot of graffiti shows, and we've had shows celebrating hip hop culture and so forth. Interesting. I think I found that the police have been pretty all right. They haven't given us too much trouble. The only time they really give us trouble is when we have a show that says the word hip hop or the word anarchy in the title. We had the Anarchist Film Festival. We hosted that at Buddy, and the cops kind of hovering around a lot, and they'd come and shut down some shows that were just celebrating the history of hip-hop culture, and we had shows that were showing videos, and we'd have, photographs of graffiti art on the walls, and maybe some people even demonstrating graffiti art inside of the gallery, and people breakdancing, and MCs. This is great shows, and the cops just kind of come, and they're irritated by, they don't like hip-hop, and they don't like anarchy.
Yeah,
but otherwise,
not.
They pretty much leave us be. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
You can draw your own conclusions, I suppose.
Yeah, indeed.
And that was Rod Milk from WZRD, who also promotes shows at a collective space up in Chicago. And with us in the studio here is Arun Bala, who also helps put on shows collectively with the IMC Shows Group, which has probably been one of the most successful collectives putting on shows in Champaign-Urbana in a long time. Thanks for being here, Arun.
Thanks for inviting me.
So what is the motivation for the Independent Media Center to have a shows group? Because I think that's actually really unique within the IMC network. There's a lot of focus on newspapers and radio shows and stuff, but less so in doing things like putting on punk shows or putting on hip-hop shows.
Yeah, I was actually thinking earlier today, up until being a member of the shows group, I didn't really think of performance or music as live music as a medium as much as, say, like a CD or a newspaper or even the radio for some reason, but it's really the first kind of medium there ever was. But so I guess that's one reason the IMC is devoted to making all kinds of media accessible to the public, both in producing it and supporting it, and live music is just another alternative for expressing your views and opinions.
And how is that different from say the shows that go on at a Cowboy Monkey or at the Canopy Club or even the Virginia Theater?
Right. Well, compared to the Virginia Theater, at least, or even Assembly Hall, which is really large, you get a more honest performance. You get to be like 3 feet away from the musician instead of 300 feet. And you get to interact with the musicians.
Is there a difference in the kind of bands that come through with the
artists?
Also,
yeah, there's a huge difference. I mean, both in terms of size or age, and also the kind of genres as well.
Let's talk about age for a second.
Right.
I mean, how is age different? I mean,
well, for one thing, we often book high school bands or
who couldn't play at a bar.
Right. Definitely. We have high school students on the booking group, and they're very active in booking these shows. So it's great that they get to have the input for the kinds of shows they want to see in town. And that's something that no other venue would really allow in town, having high school students book shows.
They wouldn't be trusted, huh?
Right.
Well, and that's interesting. So you talk about booking shows. Typically, at Cowboy Monkey, they have a promoter, and that guy books all their shows. And he's
right.
Very good at it, and people
right.
like him. But it's really one person, and that's not how it happens with IMC shows?
No, we have about 15 people on our group, and anyone's welcome to book a show. So we have a huge range of the types of bands that come through, ranging from literally like folk to hardcore and in between, punk, indie rock, blues, things like that.
So how do you pull that off with 15 people? I mean, does it like too many cooks, too many...
spoiling the soup?
Not really. Yeah. Typically one or a few people are responsible for a show they put on. So we just coordinate to make sure all the shows happen on different dates or different times. And we help train people in booking shows and doing sound and things like that and promoting their shows with flyers. And
so I have to get oriented if I want to do a show then.
Yeah, it would help. You don't really have to, but we probably wouldn't let you do the sound the first time, although maybe you would because you tend to be a bit more experienced with those sort of things. But, you know, every piece of sound equipment is different, so at the very least, we'd want to give you a little a refresher. But yeah, I mean, anyone's welcome to come to our meetings, which are every Thursday at the IMC at 7 p.m.
218 West Main Street, downtown Urbana.
That's right.
And now the shows used to happen there in the space in the IMC,
right.
And that ended early in 2000 or sort of mid-2003.
Yeah, about me.
Due to some problems with building codes. We don't want to get into that, but you're still doing shows.
Right. Most of our shows happen to be at the Channing Murray or Red Herring, which is the basement of the Channing Murray. We have a sort of special deal with the Channing Murray, so that's where we tend to have most of our shows. But every now and then we have a show somewhere else, like the Illinois Disciples Foundation, or we had an IMC Fest at the Canopy Club in early fall.
Okay, so you can even work with bigger venues,
yeah, right.
when it comes about. So you still sort of keep that idea of you're taking collective responsibility for making sure the shows go off and working with trusted organizations who think that's all right.
Right. And that's the thing. Like we tend to have a lot of people working together on these things. Last Saturday we had a punk show, and there were probably six or seven of us working together with that show, you know, staffing in various forms. And not all of us would normally go to a punk show or book a show, but we were all working out anyway.
So it really exposes each of you to some new music and experience as well.
Right.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, and I know that there's some, you know, we're hoping that the IMC can get a new home sometime, yes, in the next 12 months and that the shows can come back sort of to home base.
Yeah, it'd be great to be able to do what they're doing in Chicago, you know, having maybe a show every night or several times, yeah, a week, and having no problem and no concern about having to find a venue and that sort of thing.
And also, real quick, is there an open mic night starting up? I thought I'd,
yeah,
heard something about it.
The first one's on February 19th, which I think is a Thursday.
Okay. Is that at Channing Murray?
At the Channing Murray. And the day might change in March, maybe,
okay,
to Wednesdays. But yeah, it's starting up with the Channing Murray again.
And people can go to the UCIMC website, www.ucimc.org.
Right. Or shows, ucimc.org also has a calendar of events.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Arun.
All right. Thank you.
That brings us to the close of another edition of Media Geek. Media Geek is produced live at the studios of Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Media Geek's producer is Drew Tirico, and I'm Paul Riesmandel. The Media Geek radio show is free to rebroadcast by non-commercial stations for non-profit purposes. Please contact us for permission to excerpt. Email me at paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.